I have got an excellent guest here, Dr. E. Michael Jones, who I've never had so many people ask me to get this man on for an interview. So, Dr. E. Michael Jones, thank you very much for joining us. I know we've had a bit of a tech problems and we weren't able to use Skype, but this works totally fine. And again, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
No problem at all. So I've got to admit, I hadn't heard much about you up until a couple of months ago. And I first saw your work when you went on Mark Collette's show. I thought it might have been This Week in the Alt-Right then, or maybe it was Patriotic Weekly Review then. But I thought it was very interesting how you came out, and because Mark Collette obviously likes to talk about race, but you went straight for Catholic, the Catholicism. So you went and the Christianity, and you totally believe that the problem with Western society now is the fact that we've lost our Christianity. So, like, as Nietzsche said, God, we killed God. So would that be a fair assessment of where your position is?
Yes, nature abhors a vacuum. And what you're seeing now is a vacuum in English-speaking countries, in England in particular. The Reformation basically created state religions. They lasted for about 500 years, and now they're evaporating. And the vacuum is being filled by other identities. The other identities in England right now are Islam and white nationalism. And I'm saying both of these things are really incompatible with English tradition, because England was Catholic for 900 years before it was Protestant. And on top of that, in terms of Catholicism, you have a definite sense of what the identity is, what you believe, how you're supposed to live. You've got other cultures that have grown up under that all throughout Europe. So you have a definite sense of identity that comes with Catholicism, with that designation. And also, I would say, I mean, I'm an American, and in America, Catholicism is an ethnic identity. We have a problem with ethnic identity in America because everybody came here from someplace else, except for the Indians. And so they bring this identity with them. They're in a new country. And the theory called the triple melting pot says basically that after three generations in the United States, no matter where you came from, your ethnic identity becomes Protestant, Catholic, or Jew, that religion becomes your ethnic identity. So that's why I'm saying that. There's no content to being white. It's an empty category, and in many ways it's worse than an empty category because it's a trap. It is a trap that is prepared by your enemies, because as soon as you say you're white over here, you immediately are known as a racist, and you have so-called white privilege, which doesn't exist. But anyway, there's a whole series of traps and weapons ready to attack you as soon as you admit you're white. So it's a bad idea. It's not real. It's not a real identity, and that's why I had that disagreement.
Okay, it's an interesting take to have on the issue. So would you, I mean, you reject the identity of white or whiteness. Okay, fair enough. But you obviously, you're not rejecting the identity of someone who would say, well, I'm British, and I mean, I'm Australian. So my ancestors came to Australia in 1850s or earlier, which is basically around 50. It's about 70 years after Europeans came to Australia, and it was the gold rush here. So, I mean, we've been here for six generations, and I would say that I am ethnically Australian, and I identify as an Australian. I identify as a Christian and an Australian, or a Christian Australian. Would you say that ethnic identity is still something that people need, like that something that actually matters, because it is still your heritage?
Yeah, it does matter.
Yeah.
Because you get ethnic identity is basically defined primarily by the language that you speak, and so the simplest case is to explain it is countries in East Africa, like Tanzania, has 76 different tribes or ethnic groups, and they all speak different languages. When you have mass migration to other parts of the world, it becomes a little more difficult to explain. But in Australia, there was a homogeneity up till recently that simply did not exist in America. Beginning around the 1848, you had two main events in Europe. You had the potato famine in Ireland, and you had the revolution of 1848 in Germany and elsewhere. And this brought huge waves of immigrants to the United States for the first time, who were not, first of all, not English. The Irish, most of them spoke English, but they were not English. The Germans did not speak English. And a lot of them were Catholic. So you had a change in the identity, and it immediately led to conflict. You can't have a change in ethnic identity like that without conflict. And so there were the nativist riots of the 1840s, where the Protestants would burn down Catholic churches in places like Philadelphia, largely because the Irish were undercutting the wages of the Protestant mechanics who were living there. But so at this point, you had, over the course of the 19th century, you had large numbers of people coming over who were not English, did not speak English. And at this point, you had a campaign of assimilation that was to Americanize these people. Now, America at this point had a strong identity. It was Protestant. It was English. It was, pragmatic, scientific. You can define it any number of different ways. And the main challenge of social workers in places like Chicago was to get these people from all over to become Americans. And so the high point of this was reached in the First World War. They had things called the Triple Melting Pot pageant. And so you had erected a big papier-mâché melting pot in a baseball stadium in cities all across the North, mostly North and East. And you'd have the ethnic group showing up in their traditional ethnic clothing, and they'd play their music, and they'd march, or they'd climb up a ladder, and they'd go into the melting pot, and then they all go in there. And then the band would play the Star Spangled Banner, and they all come out wearing American clothes, and bowler hats. And this was a symbolic kind of quasi-religious ritual that basically explained to the newcomer that you had to become an American. So these people came in large numbers, and they set up little colonies called neighborhoods in every big city in the North and the East. And after World War II, the United States government declared war on these enclaves. Didn't tell them that, but they basically declared war, and that was the second phase of Americanization, which had to do with driving these ethnics, Irish, Germans, Italians, Poles, out of their ethnic neighborhoods into the suburbs, and at that point they became white. And that was middle class and white, and that was how they identified themselves, and they bought cars, and they watched television, and they became totally dominated by this new structure. So I don't know whether that corresponds. I know Australia has lately had immigration waves, but it's, as I understand it, it was pretty homogeneous up until recently.
Yeah, so Australia's history is something that I've only really just found out about and researched, because they don't teach much of it at school, our actual early history. Essentially, the story that we get is white people came to Australia and we got rid of it. We moved Aborigines away, and we're terrible for doing that. So that, it's probably something similar that you get over there, only here it's, they tell you right from an early age obviously in the government schools. But the way Australia, what actually happened here is the British came over in the 18th century, so the late 18th century. The first fleet came over, and we set up a colony in New South Wales and several other colonies around the continent. And then in the 1850s, we found gold. So gold was found mainly in Victoria and New South Wales. It's probably somewhere else, but there was a lot in Victoria and southern New South Wales, just from memory there. So what happened is, obviously, you get a gold rush, a whole lot of people coming over from Europe and also China. So we had a lot of Chinese people come over in the 19th century as well. But what happened here was people got annoyed. Like, the mainly British Anglos that came over because it was a British colony, they were getting annoyed that the Chinese came over and would do what immigrants do today, the same thing that Chinese are doing in Australia today, suppress our wages. It's not just Chinese, actually, now it's Indians and Chinese and a lot of Southern Asians and Middle Easterners and Africans even. But they'd come in and they, you know, they suppress the wages and they, you know, they build tension because they're a completely different ethnicity and they're completely different language and culture and they don't assimilate to British culture so readily because it's just the way it's, you know, this is the way God made us. So what's happened is the Australian people, the mainly British settlers in Australia, rioted several times over decades, and there were a number of riots and strikes and protests, and things got pretty violent, but not U.S. Revolutionary War violent, but you know, quite that we weren't happy. Our ancestors weren't happy, let's put it that way, and they didn't that they let their anger be known until eventually the people who were in charge, so the politicians and the leaders, said, all right, we can't have any of this, and they just kicked all the Chinese out, and we federated, so this, like, all the states became one nation in 1901, and we got the constitution, and we, pretty much the first, it was either the very first or one of the very first acts of parliaments was the immigration, was the first Immigration Act, which is designed to keep Australia a homogenous European descended ethnic state, and that was, I mean, unfortunately, they didn't put that into the Constitution. It was only implied by the Constitution. It's not like in America. I don't know exactly how the American Constitution works, but in Australia, there are a number of things that are implied within it that aren't actually explicitly written, and that was one of the things that was implied within our Constitution. But the thing about when things are implied in that manner, they can be interpreted away, and that's what's happened. So in the first after World War II, we allowed in a whole lot of refugees from Europe, so I think a lot of Greeks and Italians, maybe it was Greeks and Italians, but obviously we also let in Jews. And then you've done a lot of work on the Jews. Within 20 years they were getting in the ear of our politicians, and by 1970 our border policy was the complete opposite of what the founding fathers of our nation actually wanted. Like this Australia is supposed to be a homogenous, ethnically Anglo-Saxon nation with a few people from Europe mixed in, but they obviously, when they come over, they'd have to integrate into Australian culture and language and all of those kind of things. But since the 70s and the 60s and the 70s, we've had a lot of people come over. First of all, it was Vietnam, and then now we're especially getting people over from China and India. In the last sort of 20 years, that's what has happened there. And you can go through Melbourne CBD or Sydney CBD, and it's not even an Australian, it's not even Australia anymore. You're basically living in China. And I grew up in Hong Kong, so I walk through CBD and it literally smells like where I grew up. So I don't know if that answers your question or if you've ever heard Australian history told in that manner before.
No, I haven't.
Yeah.
All of these things can be weaponized, and immigration was weaponized in 1965 by the Jews. Jacob Javits basically changed the settings. He was a senator, United States senator, Jewish senator from New York, who basically changed the settings of the immigration quotas away from European to all parts, all different parts of the world, in a way that was deliberately intended to weaken the dominant culture. So there was a closer affinity here between Christians from Europe, even though some of them were Catholic and some were Protestant, than other groups, people from other parts of the world who were not Christian. And that was deliberately brought about, and it brought about a kind of weakening of the dominant culture. And we see the same thing happening now in Europe. I just heard a story, haven't checked it out, but a village in Ireland with 300 people had to accept 200 people from Somalia.
Yeah, I heard that.
And they have the right to bring in 20 relatives. So suddenly you could have 2,000 Somalis and 300 Irish in a village. This is a clear weaponization of immigration. And I think it has to be understood as such. And I think that's what's causing a lot of resentment throughout Europe right now.
Yeah, so what, I don't know how much you know about proprietarianism, but the way proprietarians would describe it, it's essentially parasitism. The oligarchs are imposing, it's a non-reciprocal cost on the population. And like you say, it's essentially just weaponized immigration. When we discuss it, or when I discuss it with a friend of mine, David, the way we say it, it's kind of a two or three pronged attack. So on one hand, you've got the people who are pushing it. So the oligarchs, the people right at the top who are using it as a weapon to essentially de-unify Western countries and subvert our nations and conquer us, essentially. But then it's supported by people, sort of businessmen, European businessmen. And obviously, there's a lot of who aren't European descent, ethnically European, but a lot of them who are supported because immigrants come in and they buy a lot of fridges and cars. So you've got the people who are sending it.
They also drive down wages. Sorry? The more people you add, they drive down wages, which is why we have this big fight over immigration right now in the United States. Large numbers of Mexicans have come in, and the net result is that wages go down. And Trump recognized that, and he's trying to deal with that in some way or form. But that's why the oligarchs support unlimited immigration. They know that. It also dilutes any type of national identity, which means it makes resistance harder. So it's harder to organize a group of people when people can't talk to each other. And that's the situation when you have new immigrants. The culture is so different that they can't really talk to the natives. And that brings about resentment.
And I think the most insidious thing is they import all these people who, like you say, they drive down wages. They don't integrate. They're essentially another nation and another group of people, or multiple groups of people, especially in the case of my city. And then when people start talking about it, they first of all they label you a racist or a white supremacist or an anti-Semite or whatever it is. And then when that doesn't work, they just try and remove you from public life at all. So I was going to discuss about the censorship on the internet. So that's, I think, a big part of it. And I don't know if you've noticed.
Yeah, you.
But we.
What you have is, in addition to immigration, you have a campaign of cultural warfare going on at the same time in Australia as well. Any time you see the rainbow flag flying near you, this is a sign you are a conquered province.
And that's I was just going to ask you about that rainbow flag. Sorry for interrupting, but that I just want to confirm is that that's a Jewish, old Jewish flag regarding Noahide laws. Is that correct?
Well, no, the sign of Noah that the flood was over was he saw a rainbow in the sky, but that's not where it came. That's not what we're talking about here. I think it goes back to Jesse Jackson, to be honest with you. He was a black guy from Chicago who ran for president, and he talked about the Rainbow Coalition, which was all different colors. And at some point, that's the first time it got mentioned. Then it got picked up by the homosexuals, and now it's the official banner of homosexuality. So I had a lot of back and forth with Australians when that referendum on gay marriage was coming up. And I would talk to them. I never got over there, but I'd talk to them and I'd say, you know, this is a sign that you're a conquered province. When you see that, there was a little YouTube video of a guy in Colombia. He woke up one day and there's the rainbow flag flying above the Colombian flag. So he drags it down and tears it up. Well, he understood what was going on there. There's some type of hegemony over the national government that is now controlling the policies of that country. That's exactly what's happening across the world. So the question is, I said to the Australians, your great grandfather came over in a prison ship, so he knew he was a prisoner. You know, he knew, but you don't know that. So you basically lock yourself in your own cell every night. You do it to what the British did to your great-grandfather. Now you do to yourself. Because when you vote for gay marriage, you're internalizing the commands of your oppressors. And you're bringing about a system of control into your own country. So what you see, same thing has happened here. If you go, we have a university, the University of Notre Dame. I think they have a campus in Australia. But when you go walk on that campus, it calls itself a university, but you don't see papal flags. You see homosexual flags. You see rainbow flags. And this is a sign that that is a conquered territory. It's occupied by this homosexual cabal, and they are the ones who call the shots. Homosexuality is not compatible with Catholicism. It's a disorder. It has to be treated as such. And the administration at Notre Dame has become totally paralyzed and totally incapable of dealing with it. And so they've taken over. And that's what will happen to your culture. So in addition to these immigrants, you're going to have this cultural warfare with the promotion of homosexuality. Now, interestingly, these two things do come in conflict. And so recently in England, the school board tried to impose this homosexual sex education curriculum, and the people who objected to it were the Muslims. So it backfired here. You know, they're not compatible. You know, just because you're a Muslim immigrant doesn't mean you want to go along with the homosexual agenda. That doesn't work that way. And so the system tends to defeat itself in instances like this.
So did you see the sign or the little troll thing that actually made the news in America where someone's put up a sign that said Islam is right about women? And they interview people and they don't know how to react to the thing. Like, a lot, some people are really offended, and it was actually an Aussie woman, an Australian woman who took the sign down in America and took it to the police. And she obviously doesn't understand that America has the First Amendment. But I thought when you're talking about it there, sort of, you could do another one like where Islam is right about gays, and it would probably have an even more open reaction. Because it's such cognitive dissonance. On one hand, these people are saying, well, Islam is great, it's a religion of peace, etc., etc. But on the other hand, they worship, like you said, the Church of the Gay. They worship it, right. So it's two conflicting ideas. They're not compatible. Yeah.
They're not compatible. So a classic instance of this is Michel Foucault, the French homosexual revolutionary philosopher, showed up in Tehran in 1978-79 because he thought it was going to be a repeat of the revolution in Paris of 1968, which was a repeat of the revolution of 1789. Well, it wasn't. It was the exact opposite of that. And so what happened is after the Ayatollah comes to power and the Islamic Republic comes to power, well, they don't like homosexuals, so they throw them off of tall buildings. So Michel Foucault had a mistaken understanding of what that event meant. And I think that the oligarchs are in the same position. They bring these people in. They're hoping that all these people will be assimilate according to their terms, but it doesn't work that way. It doesn't work that way. And that's what they're finding out.
I really like how you describe the flag as a sign of your conquered. You're a conquered territory. You've been conquered by the essentially globo homo, which is a really good way of explaining this ideology, because it's completely correct. And I mean, the flag is that they put it up there and they're saying this is the ideology of this territory, and they put it up in Australia, especially where I live, like in the local council, they've got the gay flag and they also have the Aboriginal flag there. And I mean, you mentioned the gay marriage thing in Australia. So that was, I think, 2015 or 16, one of those. I think it was the end of 2016, where we had this big debate about gay marriage, and it was a complete whitewash in terms of the media and the, you know, the main.
It failed because I was hoping to come over. It didn't get to come over. It didn't happen. But it failed because no one really understood what this means. The homosexual is the proxy warrior of the oligarch. This is the cutting edge of oligarchic control. So we have been through this in Indiana. The Indiana state legislature passed a law saying you could not discriminating against homosexuals, but saying that if you're a own a bakery and some homosexual comes in and tells you he wants you to bake a cake for his gay wedding, you can refuse. You have the freedom to refuse. Well, the CEOs were furious. And the CEO from Mark Benioff, the CEO of Salesforce, flew in from San Francisco and told the legislators that they had to change their law. Well, this was an outrageous act of arrogance on the part of the CEO. They have so much power now that they think they can just order the legislatures of the state around. They can tell them what to do. The governor, who is now vice president of the United States, wasn't intelligent enough to take this on the way he should have, but he should have just said, well, who elected you? Oh, wait a minute, you're not from Indiana either. Well, who gave you the right to tell us to revoke our laws? And then he should have said, officer, arrest this man. He is trying to overthrow the government of state of Indiana. We're going to put him on trial for treason. That's what should have happened, but no one was smart enough to do it. But that the man who capitalized on that was Donald Trump. And he got elected because he understood that there was disgruntled Hoosiers here, people from Indiana, who realized that the oligarchs were ruling them through proxies, and they didn't like it anymore. The classic instance of this is the mayor, the gay mayor of South Bend, Indiana. Pete Buttigieg is now running for president of the United States of America. As soon as you say that you're a homosexual, and Buttigieg is proof of this, you're telling me you cannot represent the people of the place that elected you, because you are different from the overwhelming majority of the people, and you suffer from collateral damage like narcissism. All you can see is yourself. Homosexual is a form of narcissism. And the proof of this is Pete Buttigieg. He comes here, he gets elected under false pretenses. He doesn't tell us that he's homosexual. He hides that from the voters in the only election that ever mattered, which was the Democratic primary, where he would have lost if he announced it. And then he springs it on everyone. And then during the two terms he's been here, he's hardly ever here. He's building his resume. He's running for president. He goes to Afghanistan. He's constitutionally incapable of representing the people of Indiana. And I'm saying that is the case wherever you have a homosexual. They are always the proxy warriors of the oligarchs. And so if you vote for something like gay marriage, you are basically overturning the democratic system upon which your political system is based.
Mm. And yeah, that you've said that very well. And during the debate, during the gay marriage debate, I was trying everything I could to convince as many people to vote no, we don't want to destroy the institution of marriage. It's a very bad idea. I wish I'd actually heard your stuff back then, because I would have been able to probably argue the case a little bit better. I would have offended more people, which is usually a good thing, I find, these days. But what I was saying, and what a lot of people on the no side were saying, no, if you do this, we weren't saying that they're the proxy warriors of the oligarchs. That would have been brilliant. I wish we'd argued from that point of view, because it's just so true. But what we were pointing out is, if you pass gay marriage, what do you get next? You get of everything trans, you get a tax on your freedom of speech, you're not allowed to criticize these people, and it just keeps going from there. They use it as the thin end of the wedge, and then
that's exactly,
and then
right,
they keep pushing. And I was warning this, and I had people saying that they didn't want to be friends with me anymore because I was saying this. And then what's happened 2 years later? We've got, they're constantly pushing the trans, you know, the all kids can be trans crap. They're trying to spread that as much as possible. And we now have someone in my home state of Victoria, we have an independent MP trying to get through new laws to stop people from discriminating against anyone based on their sexuality, which really means they don't want anyone to be able to criticize you based on your sexuality. And I like the way that you sort of point out that a gay, someone who's homosexual, can't actually represent the people. And I totally agree with that, because especially because homosexuals, they so often they build their identity around the fact that they are homosexual, and it's such a degenerate thing to build your identity around. I mean, this is
it is degenerate, and it's also, but it's also you're representing you are, if you say that's your identity, you have just cut yourself off from the overwhelming majority of the human race. But in addition to that, there are moral consequences for this, there are psychological consequences of these immoral actions. And one of them is fear. So first of all, if you go, what you notice at a place like Notre Dame, the more homosexual flags you see, the more fear people have, because those people have homosexual privilege. And they can come up and they can basically accuse you of thought crimes, and you have no defense. You have no defense. That's part of the problem here. What Pete wrote a autobiography, in which he talked about the Trump rally. And in this Trump rally, he said there was potential for violence. Well, first of all, no, there wasn't. I was there. There was no violence. I stood with a bunch of Hoosiers in a hall for an hour, and they were the most docile group of people I ever stood with. There's no violent possibility. So where did the threat of violence come from? Well, it came from his conscience. That's where it came from. Because he felt that what those people, what happened in Indianapolis, was an attack on him personally. Had nothing to do with him personally, but he identified in that way because that's what he is. He's identified himself with this thing. And so if you say, well, homosexual this, he feels it personally. So you elect this guy president, and he's got to conduct foreign policy. So what? All right, what's the position of Tajikistan on homosexual marriage? This is what you're going to get. He's incapable of clear thought on any of these things. That's the problem here, and that's what you're going to get when you get when you tolerate homosexuality. Deviance is constant. Okay, there's never a world where there's no deviance. And what you're saying is, if you tolerate homosexuality, you are making marriage, normal marriage between man and a woman, you're making that deviant behavior. It will end up that way. This is where it's going right now at Notre Dame. We have a young lady running for president of the council who's attacking Notre Dame for heteronormativity. In other words, it's not enough that we could let them fly the flag. Now they're upset because there seems to be a bias in favor of heterosexuality. Well, guess what? 98%, 99% of the population happens to be heterosexual. So why should there not be some type of bias in favor of that, right? Well, this is where it's going to go. You can't stop this. There's no limit to this. There's no logos to homosexuality. It's like cancer. It will keep growing until it's stopped by some type of external force.
Yeah, and it's you sort of sum it up fairly well there. And I mean, you're obviously a devout Christian, and I'm recent to coming back to Christianity. And it seems to me like in what the Bible is teaching us about homosexuality is that it's one of the worst. God punishes homosexuality, or if societies that allow homosexuality, and even from a secular point of view, that should make a lot of sense to people, because the gay people are essentially committing an act of violence against the other person. I mean, they're ramming themselves in an area that's not supposed to be. You know, it's not supposed to be entered.
It's intrinsically violent. It's intrinsically violent, and you find out that the most of the assaults on homosexuals are by other homosexuals because their sexual activity is intrinsically violent. It's unnatural, and therefore it is intrinsically violent. So it's obviously going to lead to further violence. There's no question about it.
And it's also an affront to nature as well, because the act of sexual reproduction is mostly for furthering the race and passing on your genetic material to the next stage and teaching children and bringing them up. And I mean, this is one of the this is one of the main things that we are required to do to have a fulfilling life. And that, and what the homosexuals are essentially saying is, we reject that. So they are rejecting nature. So it makes a lot of sense that nature would then reject any society that allows for such a rejection of nature. It makes logical sense, even from a secular point of view, is what I'm trying to say.
Right. Also from a sociological point of view. If you have the man who is the mayor, who is the representative of your city, engaging in immoral behavior, then why can't I engage in immoral behavior? Why is he special? How come? Why does he get some type of license to do this and I don't? I'm not a homosexual, but I would like to rob that bank. So why can't I rob the bank if he can do what he does? You know, you have a breakdown of the social norms, and this puts enormous pressure on the police department because they become involved in incidents, resolving these incidents when the violence gets out of control. It's unfair to the police to have a homosexual mayor. It is, and they know that, and they are. All you have to do is Google Buttigieg and police, and you'll see the fact that the police department is completely demoralized. Because whenever an incident happens, like a black man breaking into a car, the police shoots him. We have an instance where he will immediately take the part of the guy who got shot and not the police, without even any evidence backing this up. Because that's where he stands on these issues. First of all, all he thinks about is, how is this going to help my career? I need the black vote. I don't care whether the policemen vote for me, but the black vote is important. I screwed that up. Now maybe I can use it to repair. So he'll throw the police department under the bus, which is what he did here to further his career. So this is all of this type of stuff is completely eliminated from the mainstream media coverage of Pete Buttigieg. No one talks about it. It's all complete public relations propaganda.
Mm. And how much of today's degeneracy do you think, like the sexual degeneracy and the degeneration of society in general, how much do you think that is due to the deviance and the sexual degenerate nature of the oligarchs? So how much of it is them who they control the money supply and the avenues of power? How much of it is them actually wanting to normalize their own immoral behavior within society? Because they're using the gays as a proxy, as you say. I mean, the homosexual propaganda is even coming through our police in Victoria now. A guy I know is actually doing a really good series on that. But how much do you think is just because the people who have this power and control just want to be able to practice their own sexual degeneracy openly and without shame?
That's certainly part of it. I've written a book called Degenerate Moderns, which is about how people project their own sexuality onto the world. We had a man from Indiana by the name of Alfred Kinsey, who was a entomologist. He studied bugs, the gall wasp in particular, and then he got in sexuality doing surveys of human sexuality. Now, Kinsey was a homosexual. Now, that was completely kept out of the news when Time Magazine, which is the propaganda ministry for the CIA, when they put him on the cover, they portrayed him as kind of like a Boy Scout, you know, a straight guy. Well, he was anything but that. He was a homosexual, and he was obsessed with basically justifying his own homosexuality. And so he was only interested in interviewing homosexuals. There was a bias in the way he interviewed people, and so on and so forth. So that's clearly what we're talking about with Kinsey. But the main reason Kinsey was respectable was because the Rockefeller family funded him. And he used that over and over again to show how legitimate he was. So you have a combination of a number of different things here. You've got Kinsey, who has his homosexual compulsions, which he wants to justify to the world by breaking down sexual morality. You've got the Rockefellers, who want to break down this morality too, because they understand it as a form of control. They understand it. And that's why they were promoting it. Because if you have the moral law on your side, you can say to a guy, no, I'm not going to do it. And I don't care how much money you have, but this is immoral. Okay? If suddenly that behavior is now no longer within the realm of morality, which is what the Rockefellers were trying to do. They were trying to make it a question of opinion. Well, then you don't have as much power to resist, because you're just saying, well, it's my opinion that it's wrong. And they're saying, well, it's my opinion that it's right. And I have more money than you do, so you better go along with my opinion. Whereas if it's morality, then you say, no, I'm not going to do it. As a matter of fact, I have to die before I commit what is an immoral act, because it is an objective facet of the universe, and I'm not going to transgress it. So now you see why the rich and the powerful want to move sexual morality into the realm of opinion, because they know how to manipulate it. They can manipulate it through public opinion.
And do you think a lot of this, a lot of the push as well, comes from the Jewish desire to just rebel against God and nature and all that kind of thing? Do you think a lot of it is coming from Judaism? Because, like you say, I mean, Catholicism is very clear, and the Bible's actually really clear about sodomy. It says sodomy is a sin. Don't do it. And we can see evidence in the real world of why it's bad. But do you think a lot of the subversion has come from Jews?
I mean, I started to notice this. You know, I would do books, and it turns out I had a rabbi friend who recommended my writings to other people, and he said, "You're always talking about Jewish villains." And I didn't even think about it. And then I started to think, well, yeah, as a matter of fact, they are Jews, aren't they? You know, and like one after another. I didn't even notice this until you brought it to my attention. But when I did notice it, I thought, we need some type of explanation here why this is the case. And that's why I wrote the book, The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit. And I traced this Jewish identity back to the time of Jesus Christ, who arrives as the Messiah to the Jews. And the Jews have to accept Jesus on his terms. Which is as the Logos. He is the Logos incarnate. Logos is the order of the universe. And the majority of the Jews reject him. Some Jews accept him. They become Christians, you know, and they are the children of Moses, and we are their descendants. Okay? But the Jews who rejected him, when they rejected Christ, they rejected Logos. And when you reject Logos, you reject the order of the universe. And when your identity is based on rejection of the universe, you're known as a revolutionary. And that's what Jews have been ever since. And so in our day, one of the main theaters of revolutionary activity is sexuality. And so we have reached a point now where the consciousness is rising. People know this, and the Jewish organizations don't want you to say it, but they're trying to keep you from saying what Jews themselves are saying. So Amy Dean writes in Tikkun magazine that if it weren't for Jews, we wouldn't have gay marriage. Well, she brags about it in a Jewish magazine, and that's okay. But if I say it, and I say gay marriage is not a good thing, well, I'm called an anti-Semite. Well, this is not going to last. This double standard is not going to last. And what you're seeing now is the ADL, which is the Jewish enforcer of hate speech criteria on the internet, is reaching the point of absurdity. They just issued a statement of symbols that you cannot use. If you use the number 39, you will be called an anti-Semite.
That one.
If you use that symbol, if you do that, you are an anti-Semite. It's reached the reductio ad absurdum. We've reached the point of absurdity, and as a result, this is good, because this is the way God works in human history. He allows these people who hate the Logos to go to the logical extreme of what they're doing, make fools of themselves, and then suddenly the whole thing breaks apart, and we realize, hey, this is ridiculous. We don't have to listen to these people anymore. Andy, the Jews have one big gun, and the bullet in that gun is called anti-Semitism, and they fire at you, and if they miss, there's no second bullet. There's no, they have nothing to come back. So now people are coming back and saying, no, it's not anti-Semitism to criticize Jews. There's nothing, who said we're not allowed to criticize Jews? That's all we're doing. It's not, you're calling it hate speech because you hate to hear people criticize Jews, but there's nothing hatred about, saying that Amy Dean said Jews are behind gay marriage. She said it. Why can't I quote her in saying this? This is the point we've reached now, I think, because of the internet, and the ADL is not happy, but they're not going to win this battle. They're losing every day.
I totally agree that they're losing, because I had this discussion with someone the other day. They were trying to get me to explain how they're losing, because it seems like on the surface that they're so powerful, but it's kind of a Sun Tzu thing: you appear strong when you're actually weak. I think a lot of what we're seeing now from Jewish organizations like the ADL, we actually have our own here in Australia called the Anti-Defamation Commission, which is just even smaller, but still has major influence over public policy. They got David Icke banned from Australia. So yeah, that's I think that they are definitely losing, and what we're seeing is the death throes of their ideology, where they're coming out and they're throwing these labels everywhere that they can. You saw last week we had this, an autistic teenage girl who was a victim of child abuse coming out telling everyone that she's afraid the world's going to end because of CO2 emissions. I mean, this is what they're bringing out now. I think what we're seeing is a desperation on behalf of the oligarchy. I think they know that the game's up, but they're desperate to keep that power, because they've set in motion a number of things that if everything doesn't go their way, then they can't achieve their desired goal of one world government. All that will happen is the whole system will collapse and they'll go down with it. So I think we're seeing is panic on their behalf. Would you agree with that assessment?
Yeah, I think what we saw with that communism was years before the system actually collapsed, you had a kind of cynicism on the part of the people who just ridiculed the official explanation. And I remember thinking, we don't feel that way. We actually believe in our system here, and they don't believe in theirs, and so on and so forth. Well, we've reached the same point here. The system of political correctness, this imposition of thought control on people, telling them at the same time they're perfectly free, they have freedom of speech, and yet this draconian form of thought control and speech control is leading to widespread cynicism. And the point is that they're losing the allegiance of their own people, which is a serious thing to happen. And one of the biggest manifestations was the election of Donald Trump, who basically campaigned by saying what the mainstream media are telling you is fake news. And enough people believed him to put him in the White House. Well, that was a serious blow to these people. And they've been trying to get him out of office ever since. And he's doing his best to help them get him out of office, evidently. But it's a change in consciousness. And this is significant. So the last week, I don't know whether you heard about it, but PewDiePie, the Swede who has 100 million followers, announced that he's going to give a check for $50,000 to the ADL. A huge reaction took place among his own people, basically saying, why are you giving money to people who want to put me out of business? Why are you doing this? This is terrible. So the reaction was so extreme and so violent that he had to withdraw it within 24 hours. Now, that's a sign that the ADL is losing power, because now everybody knows that they're not involved in any of the things that they say they're involved in. They don't prevent hatred. They promote hatred. They don't prevent defamation. They promote defamation. They're a money laundering operation whose main job is to keep Jewish criminals out of jail in return for large contributions, which they channel into the mainstream economy. This is what they've been for their entire history, and now people know it. And they're saying, well, these people should not be in charge of policing the internet. Who gave them the right to do this? This makes no sense whatsoever. They shouldn't be able to tell us what we're allowed to say on the internet. No one should be able to tell us what we're allowed to say on the internet, but certainly not a group like this with all of the shady past that they've been involved in. No, no.
Well, I completely agree with you there. I was actually going to ask you about your take on the PewDiePie ADL scenario, because, I mean, I'm an online content creator, so I know all about PewDiePie. Now, do you sort of looked at it and took it at face value in that he announced that he was going to donate and then he rescinded a day later after the outrage? There are some people who are putting up the theory that he actually did it on purpose as a way of getting back at the ADL. Do you think there's any? Do you think that might be a possibility? Because if that's what's happened,
you have to get PewDiePie on your show and ask him that question. I don't know. That's a question I can't answer because I'm just taking it at face value. If you want my honest opinion, I think he tried to buy his way into respectability. I mean, he obviously the ADL had gone after him. The ADL had gotten a contract he had done with Disney canceled. Now, one of the ways that you can get yourself in the good graces of the ADL, they're an extortionist racket in addition to being a money laundering racket. And so you pay off the extortionist and then they leave you alone. And next time Disney comes around, then they don't tell you to cancel the contract. I think that's what he was doing. I hope I'm not getting myself in trouble here, but I think Mel Gibson made a contribution to the ADL just to get him off his case when he was accused of being an anti-Semite. This is what they do. I mean, let's go back. This is what the Jews do all the time, except that it's not to get them off the case with the anti-Semitism. A Jewish criminal like Mo Dalitz gave the ADL lots of money to make him legit. So by the end of his career, and the turning point came in 84. In 1934, Mo Dalitz was head of the Jewish Navy, which is a criminal operation bringing liquor in from Canada. And he was involved in gambling and prostitution in places like Newport, Kentucky. Then he went to Las Vegas and he starts throwing money around. He's got plenty of money to throw around because that's what casinos do. They bring in money. So you're bringing in, you know, I don't know, money from various unsavory sources. You give it to the ADL and then suddenly the ADL gives you their Torch of Liberty Award in 1984. And then suddenly now, if you say that Mo Dalitz is a criminal, well, you're an anti-Semite. This is what they did. And in addition to that, in 1984, the ADL got in bed with the FBI. So now they're going after criminals. They're certainly not going to go after Jewish criminals with the ADL on their board. They're going to go after hate crimes. And who gets to define what a hate crime is? Well, it's the ADL. And a hate crime is basically hate speech is anything they don't like. So now you got the government working, doing the bidding of the ADL. This is the problem with the United States of America. Following that up, we have the Bush administration in 2003, the Jews known as neoconservatives take over American foreign policy. And now we're fighting a war in Iraq that has nothing whatsoever to do with American interests. It's solely for the benefit of Israel. So this is what happens here when you're not allowed to criticize a certain group of people. They get inordinate amount of power and then they use that power to basically turn the government against you. Whether you're somebody they call hate speech, white guys, white supremacists, whatever it is they call you in the United States, or whether you're Saddam Hussein. That's the problem here. And we have to stand up to it. The time is over now. As I said, they have one bullet. They fire the bullet at you and it misses. And so that's it. What are they going to do? Say, he's really an anti. I call him an anti. He's a really bad anti-Semite. This doesn't work.
He's a super white supreme pizza. That's what I say. You know, you just make fun of the word that they use. You call it an anti-Samsonite, or it's just they use the word so often that it doesn't mean anything. And I think the brilliance of it, or and why it's such a flawed strategy on their behalf, is because all it takes is people getting a backbone and turning around and saying, well, call me that. It doesn't matter. I'm going to keep talking. It's not like I'm going to ever stop telling
can't,
the truth.
You can't define this as, I will say, I criticize Jews. I do. I'll admit that. And I can, if that's anti-Semitism, I plead guilty. Okay? But you can't tell me that there's one group in the United States of America that no one is allowed to criticize. That goes against everything that America stands for.
I completely agree. And I should thank you for that, because ever since I started watching your work and just how freely you openly criticize Jews and Judaism, it just makes me think, well, you know what? It's, I guess I can do it as well, because I've sort of been awake to the Jewish question and Jews for a little while, but I've sort of not really said anything about it because I wasn't exactly sure how to go about it as well. And, you know, there are people who have warned against it.
Well, that's why I wrote...
But then now after
that's why I wrote...
Sorry, yep.
That's why I wrote The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit, to give a coherent explanation of what we're talking about here.
And I especially like the religious explanation and the religious argument that you make. I think that makes countering the Judaism and the Jewish influence or the Jewish oligarchs a lot easier, because you can turn around and say, well, I'm a devout Christian and Jews killed my Lord and Savior. So if you're telling me that I can't criticize the people who killed my Lord and Savior, then who can I criticize? I can't criticize anyone.
That's right.
I can't do anything.
That's right.
No freedom at all.
That's why they're constantly pushing you in the direction of being a white guy and using racial terms, because they know they win once that's the case. And I said before, this critique has nothing whatsoever to do with race. It has to do with logos, not race.
Well, I mean, I agree in a sense. I think that just going for the ethnic or the white thing is incorrect. I think it's better than what a lot of conservatives are doing, but it's not the most effective means of countering the lies and essentially the Satanism, like that Satan has, or the satanic influence that has taken over our society. I think the way that we actually beat it is by returning to you'd call it logos, but you know, Christianity. And part of Christianity, I think in Christianity there is that acceptance of a variety of ethnicities and people of their own ethnic heritage, which is just family congregating and setting up nations on their own. So this is where I think a lot of people who would call themselves white nationalists, they get it backwards. They go straight for the racing and they focus completely on the racing. And because they aren't willing to go down the Christian path, it's a better strategy than we've been doing, but it's not a winning strategy. The winning strategy is to accept Jesus Christ as the Savior and the Logos and the true Son of God and listen to what he taught. And once we go back in that mode, we'll accept the natural order of the universe, and everything that these white nationalists want will come about anyway, because it's still natural order, it's still natural law, and you know,
right.
that you know, that people of the same ethnicity will set up their own nations. That's written into the fabric of the universe.
That's
yeah,
right.
So, yeah, that's just my
that's
take
right.
on it.
Jesus Christ didn't tell you what language to speak. Okay, you got that from your ethnic group. That's and the Catholic Church is completely compatible with ethnic nationalism or ethnic solidarity, as long as you keep these things in proper balance. In many ways, ethnicity is the instantiation of Christianity. You can't have an abstract Christianity of abstract people. They don't exist. The only people that exist are people who exist in a particular place who speak a particular language. And when they convert to Catholicism, when they accept Jesus Christ as the logos of the universe, they get stronger and they can resist. They can resist the outside influences better. And so you take a look at exactly, if you want to see the opposite of this, take a look at Ireland right now. They have never been weaker because they've been hornswoggled into abandoning Catholicism. Take a look at Poland as an example of of what I just mentioned. The only Poland, I gave a book tour there when the Polish edition of Libido Dominandi came out. That combined with the bishop's support of that book tour You put those two things together, and we defeated gay marriage in Poland. So let that be a lesson to you. That's an effective strategy. I know it's effective because it already worked.
Yeah, and what I completely agree. And this is what I try and do with my work, is to convince, because I know a lot of nationalists, and not enough, in my opinion, have actually converted or realized the value that you're talking about and the value of Christianity, and just how effective a tool it is at fighting against the things that these people are completely against. But there seems to be a resistance amongst a lot of nationalists to the idea of Christianity. And I mean, in a way, I empathize with it because they've been subverted, and I was in that situation, and it took something fairly extreme for me to go and come back to the Christian way of life. So I empathize with them. I understand why they might not want to come over and accept the truth. But, you know, I think we still need to... I definitely feel like I need to work on convincing them, and you're doing a lot of really good work regarding that as well, in my opinion.
Yeah, I did. I spent a week in Guadalajara with David Duke trying to convert him to Catholicism. And I wrote a book about it. It's called Ethnos Needs Logos. And it's available on Amazon Kindle, so you don't have to wait for months for me to ship it to Australia. You can go and download it right now. If you're interested in this debate about the interface between ethnos, ethnicity, ethnic identity, and logos, or the universal principles that you have with Jesus Christ in the Catholic Church, there is a way to bring these two things together. And the problem is, if you don't bring them together, then you're going to lose. That's the issue.
Correct. And I think that it's really important to understand that if you have to interpret Christianity in a way that marries up to natural law. It's so important. And when they do marry up to natural law, as I mentioned, and as you mentioned, you get everything that you want as a white ethnic nationalist anyway, because you marry Christianity up to the natural order of the universe, which is the way it's supposed to be, and everything kind of falls into place. It's just, I don't know what it is. Maybe it's a bit of self, maybe it's a bit of ego where they don't want to come into that, or maybe they just haven't been taught that. Maybe it hasn't been,
They want to lead dissolute lives. Let's be honest here. A lot of these white guys want to screw as many women as they want to screw, and that's the main barrier to them accepting Jesus Christ, because he requires a kind of adherence to the moral law. So let's be honest about this. I mean, to go through, I was on with Richard Spencer and Jim Goad. If you want to know, you know, look into Jim Goad's life, you know. And you'll understand why there is this reluctance, you know. But it's self-defeating, you know. You're not going to end up with a happy life if you go down that road.
Yeah, I agree. Now, just one last question, because I think we're just over an hour now, which is about where we need to sit at. So, are you ever considering a speaking tour of Australia? Are you gonna come and maybe discuss your ideas? Do you think you'd be able to do a tour of Australia? Because if you were to come over here, then you'd probably get some really good protests, and it would be, I do vlogs of events when people come over, so it would be pretty good content. So are you planning on anything like that?
Yes, I am.
Can we ask when, or should we just sit tight and wait patiently?
We will. In the future at some point or other. So it is going to be in the works, and I will keep you posted as it develops.
Fantastic. That's really good to hear. So before you finish, where can everyone find you, and how can they follow you, and what's the best place, the best way to...
We need to establish secure channels of communication to counter the psychological warfare that's being waged against us. So go to culturewars.com and buy something. Buy a book.
Yes, and at least...
Buy one of the books that I've mentioned on. You'll learn a lot, and we will establish, you'll be on my list as opposed to Google's list, you know, and we will establish secure channels of communication, and you will know how to get the Logos book. It's finished. It'll be out soon. or how to make contact with me. So go to culturewars.com.
Fantastic. And everyone, if you're wanting a book to read, or if you want me to want a recommendation, then I'll definitely recommend the Jewish Revolutionary Spirit. It's not just a really good social commentary on Judaism and the effect of the Jews. It's actually a really good historical book. It's amazing how the discussion of Poland and Spain and how the Jews interacted there and the effect that they had on the local population in, I think, the 16th century. So if you like history, you'll really enjoy that book as well. But anyway,
I just got word today from a friend who's a priest who told me he just got contacted by a Jew from California who read the Jewish Revolutionary Spirit, said it confirmed everything that his family told him, and as a result of reading, he's going to become a Catholic. So it's that kind of book.
It is an excellent book. I'm about halfway through it. I just passed the bit where you talk about the Jewish influence on the porn industry, which was illuminating. So I think it's definitely a book that everyone should read in their life if they want to understand the world better. And on that note, Dr. E. Michael Jones, really appreciate your time. It's been an excellent interview. The information you've given is fantastic. I'm sure that anyone who's watched this is going to be very, if they haven't heard your views before, they're going to find them interesting or very offensive, depending on the position that they're coming from. Again, I really, really appreciate your time, and thank you for the great work that you've done over the last 40, 50 years.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Everyone else, we'll see you around.